True north and magnetic north are not the same thing. Down here, that doesn't matter much. But try to use a compass near the pole and it'll mess with your head. I use it mainly to walk point to point.
Point to point?
A compass can't tell you where you are, only the direction you're headed or have come from. A right-handed person like me will walk in a right-turning circle if given enough time without a compass. To walk in a straight line, you pick a direction, a degree on the compass, say 110 degrees or 270 or 30 or whatever, then pick a visual marker somewhere in front of you that lines up with that point on the compass. A tree, a mountaintop, lake, bush, whatever. Once you get there, you pick another. But this time you use the point behind you as a reference point, double-checking yourself, hence point to point. Not difficult, but takes patience and some practice.
Will that compass help us get out of here?
Her tone suggested something I'd not heard. The first outward sign of fear.
Yep.
Make sure you don't lose it.
Check.
I lay awake until Ashley started snoring. The drugs did that. When I couldn't sleep, I slid out from underneath my bag, pulled on my long underwear, jacket, and boots, and walked outside. I opened the compass and let the needle settle beneath the moonlight. Remember how elated we were to get that job offer in Jacksonville? We jumped at it. Back to the beach, the ocean, the smell of salt, taste of sunrise, sound of sunset. We were moving back home, closer to your parents. But you were the activities coordinator at the children's hospital and couldn't stand the thought of leaving a week before your replacement arrived. So driving the moving truck, Denver to Jacksonville, from the Rockies to the beach, fell to me. All 1,919 miles. I told you I'd buy you a condo, any house you wanted, but you said you liked the one I already had. You hung on the truck door, swinging on squeaky hinges, left heel in the air and pointed to the floorboard. I left you a present, but you can't open it until you get out the driveway. On the floor in front of the passenger seat sat a cardboard box. A silver handheld tape recorder was taped to the lid. Attached to it was a piece of paper that read, "Press play." I backed out of the drive, put the stick into drive, and pressed play. Your voice rose up out of the tiny machine. I could hear your smile.
"Hey, it's me. Thought you'd like some company."
You licked your lips like you do when you're nervous or being mischievous. "Here's the deal. I'm worried about losing you to the hospital, about being a doctor's widow, sitting on the couch, a spoonful of Rocky Road in one hand, the remote in the other, flipping through the plastic surgery catalog. I gave you this thing so I can be with you even when I'm not, because I miss the sound of your voice when you're away, and I want you to miss mine. Miss me. I'll keep it a day or two, tell you what I'm thinking, then give it to you. We can pass it back and forth, sort of like a baton. Besides, I've got to compete with all those pretty nurses who'll be swooning over you. I'll have to beat them off you with a stick or stethoscope." "Ben," your tone of voice changed from serious to playful. "If you need to hear someone swoon, get weak in the knees, flushed in the face, play doctor, just press play. Deal?" I nodded in the rearview mirror.
"Deal."
You laughed. "There are a couple of things in this box that will help you on your trip. You're holding the first, the others are marked with numbers, and you can't open them until I say so. Deal? No kidding. If you don't agree, I'm clicking off. No more me. Got it?" "Good. Glad we got that settled. I guess you can go ahead and open the second now." I pulled out a small envelope containing a CD and slid it into my player. Your voice continued, "Our songs." You had little trouble communicating what you felt. You wore your heart on your sleeve, and what your heart felt your mouth could say, and did. Your folks had spent a lifetime teaching you to do that. My dad had spent a lifetime browbeating me whenever I tried to tell him how I felt. He said any expression of emotion was a weakness that needed to be ripped out. douse it with gasoline, and throw a match on it. The result made me a decent ER surgeon. I could act without feeling. Over the next 24 hours, you held the recorder to your mouth and took me with you everywhere you went, babbling with every step. You always had a thing with kids. So first thing, we drove to work, the children's ward where you walked me into each room, called each child by name, snuggled with each or took them a teddy bear or played a video game or played dress-up. You never hesitated to get on their level. And in truth, much of what I know about bedside manner, you taught me. They saw the recorder and asked you what you were doing. You held the recorder and each one talked to me, their little voices exploding with laughter and hope. I didn't know much about their conditions or their doctors, but I could hear it in their voices. The effect of you on them was palpable, and they would miss you. We went to the grocery store, checking off items on your list. To the mall to find some shoes and a gift for some party, to get your hair cut where the stylist talked about her boyfriend's body odor problem. When the stylist walked to the register to welcome another client, you whispered into the recorder, "If she thinks her boyfriend stinks, maybe she ought to run with you." You then took me to get a pedicure where the lady told you that you had too many calluses on your feet and you ought to run less. Then to a matinee where you crunched popcorn in my ear and told me to close my eyes because the guy was kissing the girl. Just kidding. You kiss better than him. He's gross. You ask me how I know about such things? Oh. I could hear more smiling. I know. After the movie, you walked me to the bathroom door where you said, "You can't come in here. Girls only." As I drove through Alabama, you took me to our favorite diner where you smacked key lime pie in my ear and said, "Sounds good, doesn't it?" It did, too. Then you said, "Look in the box and pull out the big one that says dessert." I did. "Now open it, but be careful." I lifted the lid and found a piece of key lime pie. "Thought I forgot all about you, didn't you?" I pulled into a rest area, and we all ate key lime pie together. You took me to our room, lay down, where I was already asleep, dead to the world. You lay next to me, running your fingers through my hair, scratching my back. "I'm going to sleep now, next to you. But you can't go to sleep until you get to our condo by the sea. I'm wrapping my arms around your waist. You're skinny. You need to gain some weight. You've been working too much." Then you paused. You were quiet several minutes. I only knew you were still there because I could hear you breathing. You whispered, "Ben, somewhere in miles gone by, somewhere between way back there and here, I gave you my heart, and I don't want it back, ever. You hear me?" I found myself nodding. You interrupted me. "Hey, no nodding at the road in front of you. You've got to say it out loud." I smiled. "I hear you." It's snowing again. Ashley's in a lot of pain and starting to show the effects of elevation. I've got to get her down or she's going to die up here, I know. But if I don't try, we'll both die. Grover, I need to bury him. But I'm not sure I have the strength. He may already be buried. Plus, there's something up in the rocks that's got me a bit worried. I've got to get some rest. The wind's picking up. When it blows out of the south, it funnels through the fuselage, sounding a low whistle, like blowing across the top of a beer bottle. It sounds like a train that never arrives. I've been studying the compass, trying to find a way out, but it's mountains all around. Tough to know which way to go. If I choose the wrong degree, well, things are bad here. Real bad. I want to tell people that Ashley was trying to get home. I wish they knew. But chances are good they never will. Chapter 13. I woke with the sun, groggy and sore, rolled over, pulled the bag up over my face, and woke again around lunch. No matter how hard I tried, I could not get out of bed. I don't ever remember sleeping through an entire day, other than the one after the crash. Evidently, my adrenaline had finally given out. Ashley seldom stirred. Elevation mixed with starvation, mixed with a plane crash, mixed with a lot of pain, had taken its toll on both of us. Toward sundown, I finally crawled out of my bag and stumbled onto the snow. I hurt everywhere and could barely move. Daylight on day 6, the fire had long since died out. But my clothes were dry, so I pulled them on, forced myself to pack my backpack, rekindled and restarted the fire to keep her warm, and dropped a few handfuls of fresh snow into the jet boil for her when she woke. I tried not to look at Grover. We needed food. I shouldered my backpack, tied the bow onto the back of it, and stepped out as the sun was just coming up. The air was crisp and dry with ice crystals floating on her breath. I threw fresh snow across the tracks at the entrance. It would let me know if anything visited while I was away. I tied on the snowshoes, pulled out my compass, took a reading, spotted a rock outcropping maybe a half mile in the distance, and set off. I didn't have the advantage of a mountaintop perspective, so the compass would prove invaluable. For 3 hours, I picked points and plowed through the snow. It was dry and frozen rather than sticky and wet, but I had to keep stopping to tighten my gaiters around my knees. The first lake turned up nothing, so I walked the frozen perimeter until I found the creek that spilled out of it. While the surface of the lake was frozen, the creek was not. The water was clear, clean, and tasted almost sweet. It was cold, and I risked dropping my core temperature, but I was moving, so I kept forcing myself to drink. Eventually, my pee turned nearly clear, a good sign. A mile later, the creek made a hard turn left, creating a deep pool below a rock overhang. The banks were mounded with snow. I didn't put too much faith in my ability to work that fly rod with my hands. They were too cut up and cold to do anything effectively. And not having done much fly fishing, I couldn't figure out why a fish would bite at a fly that it knows good and well can't live in conditions like these. Fish aren't stupid. Grover had a small bottle of imitation salmon eggs. They look like red or orange peas. I slid one over a hook, threaded line through the hook, and dropped that single egg into the water. 20 minutes later, no bites. I packed up and looked for a bigger pool. A mile later, I found one. Same routine, same outcome. Only this time, I could see little black shadows darting in and out beneath the rock and into the swirling current. Lots of black shadows. I knew there were fish here. Why wouldn't they bite? I guess that's why they call it fishing and not catching. 30 minutes later, an ineffective popsicle, I packed up and continued trudging through the snow, looking for another pool. I was tired, cold, and hungry. This time I had to climb a small rise and then descend to another stream. With the elevation and the pain in my ribs, even a simple rise meant a lot of work. I was expending calories I couldn't afford. I climbed over, then descended, and walked down to the bank of one more stream. This one was wider, maybe twice as wide, but more shallow and still running with a good volume of water. The black shadows reappeared. A good number, too. I brushed away the snow and lay on the rock, a face-down snow angel, salivating at the sight of mountain trout. This time I lowered Grover's hand net slowly into the water below the bait. The problem with this method was that it submerged one hand into the water that was probably 28 degrees. The pain was excruciating until it went numb, which didn't take long. The shadows disappeared, then slowly returned, swimming closer. Slowly they approached the egg and began to nibble. Maybe it was the cold water, but they too were sluggish. I slowly raised the net and caught 7-finger-sized trout. I dumped them into the snow several feet from the creek and buried my cold hand into the pocket of my down jacket. With the hatchet, I cut a limb, lashed it to the net, and submerged both it and the egg, catching a couple more. I ate everything but the heads. When they were gone, I crept back to the bank and kept fishing. I did that on and off for more than an hour. When the sun started casting my shadow in the snow, I counted my catch, 47. Enough for us tonight and tomorrow. I packed up and followed my tracks home. The packed snow, along with colder temperatures that had frozen the surface, made my return quicker. On the way back, I pulled an arrow from the quiver, knocked it, took a deep breath, and drew hard on the string. It resisted, then gave and released all the way to my face. The pain in my ribs was sharp, but I had the bow at full draw. I set the top pin on the base of a wrist-size evergreen some 20 yards away, and released. The arrow missed the base by about 2 inches and disappeared in the snow on the right. I dug around a few minutes and retrieved the arrow, embedded in the frozen earth. Drawing the bow was not something I could do quickly, but it was something I could do. And while I had not hit the tree, I was close. And at that distance, close was good enough. It was well after midnight when I climbed back onto our plateau. Oddly, it was plenty light. I approached the last half mile slowly, keeping my eyes peeled for anything moving. I saw nothing, but the entrance to our cave told a different story. Beneath the moonlight, there was no mistake. The tracks were closer, parked right at the entrance, with a rounded indentation between them where something had lain down, resting its stomach on the snow. Chances were good that it was lying here as I walked up. Chances were also good that it was lying in wait, less than 100 feet from me now. Ashley was weak, and her eyes hurt. Classic altitude sickness mixed with a concussion and lack of food. I found some more wood, stoked the fire, gutted 6 trout, and fed them onto a long, slender stick, piercing them through the middle like a kebab. I cooked them and made coffee at the same time. Caffeine would help her digest and absorb the nutrients, not to mention fight the hunger. She drank and ate slowly as I held the cup to her lips and then peeled off a fish and held it while she chewed. She ate 14 like that and drank 2 cups of coffee before she shook her head. Napoleon sat quietly licking his face. I laid out 6 fish on the snow in front of him and said, "Go ahead." He stood, smelled them, wiggled his nose, and devoured them, eating everything, including the heads. I gave Ashley the last of the Percocet, packed and elevated her leg, and checked the circulation in her foot. She was asleep before I realized we hadn't said 2 words to each other since I'd returned. I sat up a few more hours feeding the fire, making myself eat, watching the color return to her skin, and listening as her shallow breaths deepened. Much of that time, I sat in my bag with her foot pressed to my stomach. Just before midnight, I walked outside. As I did, a long shadow disappeared up a rock face and into some trees on my left. Napoleon stood next to me, snarling. He'd heard it, too. Chapter 14. Caught some fish today. Sort of like big sardines without all the mustard sauce and aluminum can. Nothing to brag about, but we're alive. And I shot the bow. If it came to a pinch, I think I could hit what I'm shooting at, as long as it stayed inside 20 or 25 yards. I know, not many things will. But it's better than jumping around and waving my arms in the air. Ashley is sleeping. I gave her the last of the Percocet, hoping she'll get some sleep, maybe put some energy back in her tanks. I need to put together a plan. I know folks will tell you to never leave the crash site, but we've got to get down out of here. Even if a helicopter was hovering 100 feet over us, I'm not sure they could see us. It snowed almost 4 feet in 5 days. We're pretty well buried by now. Speaking of which, I'm going to move Grover tomorrow. Get him someplace where he can see the sun come up and set. Where he can count the stars at night. Someplace a good distance from us. I'll have to make a stretcher of some sort, but I can use that again when I move Ashley. You remember that cabin in the mountains? Our daytime hikes? Nighttime fires, watching the snow stick to the windows as a mountaintop wind leaned against the door and whistled atop the chimney? Our honeymoon? The second night, we'd finished dinner and were sitting in front of the fire. Between our student loans and the cost of life, we didn't have 2 pennies to rub together. I think we paid for the cabin with a then-maxed-out credit card. drinking a cheap bottle of Cabernet. You were wearing your robe. And my sweat. Seems I remember that we'd agreed on a no-present wedding. Promised to do it again when we could afford it. Good thing I knew better than to put much stock in that. You reached behind the couch and handed me the box. Wrapped perfectly. Topped with a red bow. Every corner perfect. You raised both eyelids and said, "This is something you desperately need." The firelight was dancing across your skin, the vein on your left arm. I thought we agreed no presents. And you said, "This isn't a wedding present. It's something you need if we're going to stay married for 70 years. 70 years? You nodded and then asked, "You sure you're going to love me when I'm old, wrinkly, and can't hear a word you're saying?" "Probably more." You crossed your right leg over your left, and the split in your robe climbed halfway up your thigh. Then you said, "You're going to love me when my boobs sagged my belly button?" There I was, marveling at the picture of you. And you were thinking about sagging boobs. Still can't believe you said that. I stared up into the pine rafters, shook my head once, and tried not to smile. "Don't know. Might be difficult. You're a runner. You don't have much sag to begin with." You slapped my arm. "You better take that back." I laughed. When I was a kid, I saw that very thing in National Geographic, and it's not pretty. Cured me from wanting to look at girly magazines. You pointed at me, your voice rising. "Ben Payne?" Your crooked, double-jointed finger was pointing everywhere but at me. "You are flirting with the couch. You better watch it." "Okay, but if you start sagging to your belt, we might consider a tuck here and a nip there." You nodded. "Trust me, we'll be tucking and nipping long before that. Now open." I remember staring down at the split and marveling at how comfortable you were at being with me. Your smile, the tired eyes, sweat above your ears, flushed cheeks, firelight, laughter, beauty, spunk, all of you. I remember closing my eyes for a brief second and burning the image onto the back of my eyelids because I wanted to take it with me. And I did. "Rachel, you're still the measuring stick. No one else holds a candle." You smiled. "The way I look at it, there's Eastern Standard Time, and then there's Ben Time. And Ben Time can be anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour and a half behind. This could help that little problem." You were right. I'm sorry I was ever late for anything. I peeled away the paper, and there sat a Timex Iron Man. You pointed at the face. "Look, it has no hands, so you can see exactly what time it is, down to the exact second. And to help you out, I set it 30 minutes fast." "Have you ever thought that maybe everyone else is just randomly early?" "Nice try, but..." You shook your head. "No." You curled up against me, your back to my chest, your head on my arm, and we talked and laughed as the coals turned white and the snow painted the windows. An hour or so later, just before you dozed off, you whispered, "I set the alarm." "What for?" You pressed against me, pulled my arm tight, and we drifted off. When the alarm sounded, I was somewhere beyond a deep sleep. I jumped and tried to focus. 3:33 a.m. I reached for my wrist and punched every button, trying to get it to hush, not wanting to let it wake you. Moonlight broke through the skylight and showered both of us, casting our shadow on the wall, highlighting the tips of your hair. Finally, I just stuffed the watch under my pillow, because I couldn't get it to shut up. It sounded for a full 60 seconds. You laughed, dug yourself deeper beneath the covers. The room was cold. Fire dim, coals a dull red. My breath a misty cloud of smoke. I slid out, naked on the floor, goosebumps crawling up and down. You tucked the cover beneath your chin, studied me, smiled. Tired eyes, you whispered, "You cold?" My embarrassment was obvious. "Very funny." I stoked the fire, added 3 logs, slid back under the blanket, which, if I remember correctly, was a fake bear rug. And you slid your leg across mine, then placed your chest to mine. Warm. You cradled me. I asked,
"Why did you set it for the middle of the night?"
You wiggled, wedging yourself closer to me. Your feet were cold. You pressed your lip to my ear.
"To remind me."
"Of what?"
"That you'd be cold."
Sometimes I wonder how you ever fell for me. You believe in things you cannot see and speak a language that only hearts know.
Oh.
A while later, the first ray of daylight broke through the ridgeline, crowned in blue, red crimson spilling across a sea of black. You lifted my hand off your chest and pushed the button on the watch, green light showing the space around us. You whispered, "When you push this, and the light shines back at you, you think of us, of me." You laid your head against me, staring up, and pressed my hand flat across your chest, you in the center of my palm, hiding nothing, your heart pounding inside. You said, "Of this." Chapter 15. Napoleon's growling woke me up, low and different. His tone told me he wasn't kidding. I opened my eyes to ice crystals hanging in the air on my breath. Ashley lay quietly. Her breathing had become labored again. The dog stood between us, staring at the entrance. Moonlight filtered in, casting shadows. It was bright enough to walk outside without a flashlight. Napoleon lowered his head and took 2 slow steps toward the entrance. 2 eyes stared back at us, crouched low, seemingly growing out of a shadow. They looked like 2 pieces of red glass. Behind the shadow, something waved, like a flag. There it was again. This time, more like smoke from a fire. I sat up on an elbow, rubbed my eyes, and Napoleon's growl grew deeper, louder, more angry. I put my hand on his back and said, "Easy." Evidently, he didn't understand that. As if shot out of a cannon, he launched himself toward the thing staring back at us. The 2 collided, spun in an angry ball. A loud cat-like roar erupted from the middle of the ball and then disappeared, leaving Napoleon standing at the entrance, barking and jumping 2 feet straight into the air. I crawled toward him, wrapping my arms around him and pulled him backwards. "Easy, boy. It's gone. Easy." He was shaking and his shoulders were wet. Ashley clicked on the flashlight. My palm was sticky red and the snow was splattered red beneath us. Didn't take me long to find the cut. It was deep from the side of his shoulder toward the top of his back. I grabbed my needle and thread, and Ashley held him still while I stitched him up. He didn't like me poking him with a needle, but I closed it with 4 stitches, and given the location, he couldn't chew at it. He chased it, turning in a few circles, but gave up, stared at the entrance, then licked me on the face. "Yeah, you did good. I'm sorry I ever thought about eating you." Ashley cleared her throat.
"What was it?"
"Mountain lion."
"Is it coming back?"
"I think so."
"What does it want?"
"Us." She closed her eyes and didn't say anything for a while. We slept in fits throughout the rest of the night. Napoleon curled up in my bag, but kept his eyes on the entrance. I scratched his head, and it didn't take him long to fall asleep. I perched the bow next to my bag, knocked an arrow, and propped myself up against the tail of the plane. Only when the sun came up did I finally drift off. When I woke, Ashley lay half-turned, staring left, the flare gun in her hand. Napoleon, too, was trained on the entrance. Something was crunching the snow below us. I crawled out, grabbed the bow, and clipped my release onto the string. Compound bows look complicated, but in truth, they're simple. The release is like a trigger. It takes the place of your fingers, so that the same thing happens exactly the same way over and over again. You draw, hold the pin on the target, and squeeze the release. The release lets go of the string, sending the arrow toward the target. Grover's bow was a good one, a Matthews. His draw was a bit longer than mine, but I could manage. I crawled forward and saw some sort of fox hopping around the rocks below us. Snow white. It was one of the prettier things I'd ever seen. I held my breath, drew the bow, held on the fox, and released. The arrow flew over the fox, maybe 2 inches high. The fox disappeared. Through clenched teeth and a white-knuckle grip on the flare gun, Ashley whispered, "What happened?" "Missed. Too close." "How do you miss something that's too close? I thought you said you could shoot that thing." I shook my head. "Shot over it." "What was it?" "A fox of some sort." Things had turned for the worse. Chapter 16. It was weird owning the place that was the source of so many tough or bad memories. But you just shook your head and smiled. "Give me 6 months. Let me remodel, paint, get some new furniture, and I'll give you new memories. Besides," you put your hands on your hips, "paid for and oceanfront are both really cool." So we gutted walls, repainted, retiled, redid pretty much everything. Seemed like a totally different place. Dad liked closed blinds, dark colors, little lighting, no visitors. More like a cave. You went for cool blues, soft tans, open windows with the blinds rolled up, sliding glass doors cracked so the sound filtered through, wave upon wave. How many nights has the sea sung us to sleep? You remember the night of that crash? I'd worked late because 2 Cadillacs, overflowing with people, had been hit by a tow truck. The ER was slammed. My shift ended at 4 the previous afternoon, but the first ambulance arrived just minutes before with promises of more to come. I'd stayed until we had everybody stable, at least those that could be stabilized. I was tired, thinking about life and how short it is. How we're always just a breath away from overturned in the ditch with a fireman cutting you out with the jaws of life. It was just one of those moments where I knew, really knew, that life is not guaranteed, that I take it for granted. I wake up each day thinking I'll wake up tomorrow, too. It's not necessarily true. It was early, maybe 3 a.m. The ocean was angry ahead of a storm. Sideways wind, stinging rain mixed with sand, frothy churn, choppy waves, thunderous noise. A storm was coming in, and any idiot could tell the undertow would be severe. Anyway, I was standing at the glass wrestling with life's impermanence, staring out over the beach. You appeared in a silk robe, tired eyes. You said, "You okay?" I told you what happened, what I was thinking. You tucked your shoulder under mine, wrapped your arms around my waist. Minutes passed. Lightning spiderwebbed the sky. "You owe me something, and I want to collect." Seemed a strange way to start a conversation when I was sharing my deepest thoughts. Sort of irritated me. I guess my voice betrayed this. "What?" Admittedly, I'm a bit of an emotional blockhead. I'm still sorry. I don't know how long you've been wanting to bring this up. Don't know how long I'd missed the signals. Looking back, you'd been firing shots across my bow for months, and I was too wrapped up in work to pick up on them. But you'd be patient. I'd keep telling you, "Just let me get through medical school." I guess you figured it was time to ramp up your efforts. You stepped aside, untied your robe, let it slip to the floor, and started walking to our room. At the doorway, you turned. A candle in our bedroom lit one side of your face. "I want to make a baby, right now." I remember watching you disappear into the warm glow of candlelight, the flash of a shadow across the small of your back. I remember staring back into the glass and shaking my head at the idiot in the reflection staring back at me. I remember walking into our bedroom, kneeling next to our bed and saying, "Forgive me?" I remember you smiling, nodding and pulling me toward you. A while later, I remember you lying on my stomach, your chest pressed to mine, your tears trickling onto my chest, a tired smile, trembling arms. And I remember that moment when I knew that you'd broken loose in me the stuff that only love breaks loose, that you'd given me all of you, unselfishly, unreservedly. Something about that gift struck me, something about the enormity of that touch me down where words don't live, where expression fails, where there are no secrets, where there's just you and me, and everything that's us. And I remember crying like a baby. That's when I knew. When I knew for the first time what love was, not what it felt like, not how it made me feel, not what I hoped it was, but what it was, and what it was when I didn't get in the way. You showed me. It had been there all along. But something about that night, those people, the sense of gain, loss, heartbreak, and joy, all those things swirled into that moment, and I'd lived my whole life wanting to love, but never able to do so apart from the pain that I'd carried. The pain of my dad, of my mom's absence, of running but never being fast enough, of never measuring up. But there, that night, that moment, it was the first time I'd ever been cut free. When I took a breath deep enough to fill me, all my life I'd struggled in the waves, tossed, turned, thrown about like a rag doll, forever trying to surface, screaming for air, but somewhere, some unseen hand held me beneath the foam and froth. But in that moment, you held back the waves, lifted me above the surface, and filled me. Chapter 17. Grover was stiff when I tried to move him, frozen in a sitting position, his head tilted a bit to one side, one hand still holding the stick. His eyes were closed. Ashley turned her head. I popped off a section of the wing, laid him on top of it, and slid-pushed him out the entrance. I pulled him across the snow to a boulder covered in lion tracks. I brushed the snow off, sat him on the rock, and leaned him backward. I backtracked, counting 18 steps. I knocked an arrow, aimed it at the snowdrift a few feet away from Grover, and released. This time, I didn't shoot over. The distance was far enough to allow the arrow to flatten out, while not so far away that I couldn't hit what I was aiming at. Napoleon kept running back and forth between Grover and me. He'd started limping, and his circles had developed a hitch. He looked up at me. "I won't let anything happen to him." Napoleon walked back into our disintegrating cave. Everything about this location was bad. I needed to get us out of here. But I had two problems. First was my energy level. I'd have less tomorrow and even less the next day. Secondly, having spent part of my residency on the West Coast, where mountain lions thrive, and having seen what they can do to unsuspecting people, and having seen how often they do it, I had no intention of spending the next few days looking over my shoulder. I crawled in. Ashley's face was wet. She was breaking down. "What are you doing?" "Hunting." "Are you using Grover as bait?"
"Yes."
She didn't say anything. "But if it works the way I'm thinking, then nothing will happen to him." "Not to point out the obvious, but nothing has worked out the way you'd hoped since we met in Salt Lake." She was right. I had no response. I nodded. I just knew I wasn't going to sit in our cave and wait for that thing to come back. Using Grover helped tilt the odds. Maybe not in my favor, but not in that thing's either. If it went my way, then Grover would never know it and would be no worse for it. If it didn't, well, he was dead already, and I'd bury him before Ashley had a chance to see what had happened. We didn't say much the rest of the day, or that night, or the next day. By the time the second night came around, I hadn't slept soundly in 48 hours and was running on fumes. So was Ashley. The cold had intensified. I couldn't say for sure, but it was crisp and painful, suggesting that it had fallen into the negatives. Clouds moved in, blocking out the moon, and that was bad. I needed the moon. Without it, I couldn't see the sight pin. Midnight came and brought snow. I was sleepy, fading in and out. I could see the outline of Grover just across the snow. Based on the layer covering him, we'd had another 3 inches of snow. I must have fallen hard asleep because I jerked when I woke. Napoleon lay next to me, crouched. His eyes were focused on Grover. Something was leaning on Grover, and the thing was big, 6+ feet in length. My hands were nearly frozen, but I drew the bow and tried to find the pin. There was no way to see it in the dark. Come on, just a glimmer of light. Still nothing. I swung the bow, knowing I only had another second or two. My arms were cramping, and my chest felt like somebody had stuck me with a spike. I coughed, tasting blood. I was weakening. I needed light. My arms were shaking. Next to me, something brushed my leg, then I heard a click, and somebody shot a Roman candle out the entrance to the cave. The flare gun exited in a long space shuttle arc, and then hovered a metallic orange, maybe 100 feet above us. The light showered down, casting shadows. The cat had both his paws on Grover's shirt like they were dancing. It looked up, arched its neck. I found the pin, leveled it on the cat's shoulder, and pressed the release. I never saw the arrow. I dropped the bow, fell back, clutching my side and trying to breathe. I coughed, tasted more blood, and spat on the snow next to me. Ashley lay to my right, staring out. It's gone. Did I hit it? I had hunched over, nursing my ribcage. The spasm was traveling around my back, further shortening my breathing. Don't know. It left in a hurry. Somewhere in the darkness, my hand found hers. We lay there, catching our breath. I was too tired to carry her back down to her back, so I pulled her up to my chest, wrapped us in my bag with my arms around her waist and chest. Within minutes, her head fell to one side and her pulse slowed. Morning woke us. Napoleon lay curled between us. I climbed out of my bag and saw what Ashley had done last night. Drag marks in the snow told the story. I needed to check her legs, so I lifted the bag and ran my hand gently along the skin. The skin was dark, and the swelling had returned. The hair on her leg was stubbly, 10 days overgrown. The pulse in her ankle was good. The problem was the swelling. The skin was taut. Moving last night had been traumatic, not good. She'd set herself back. The pain would be intense, but we were out of Percocet. I tilted her head, placed 2 Advil on her tongue, and she sipped and swallowed. I propped her head on my bag, dressed, tied up my boots, knocked an arrow, and stepped toward Grover. He had fallen over, or been pushed, and looked like he was asleep on his side. A trail of blood led away up the rocks, a constant trail. It had been several hours, which was either real good or real bad. If the mountain lion was mortally wounded, then those several hours would have given it time to die. If it was just sort of wounded, those several hours would have given it plenty of time to regather its strength and get angry. I turned to Napoleon and held out my palm like a stop sign. Stay. Take care of Ashley. He climbed inside her bag, only his nose sticking out. My breath was a thick cloud of smoke and bit at my nose. The cold was painful. I climbed the rocks and followed the blood. It thinned, which was bad. A thin blood trail means a bad hit and probably an angry, injured lion. After 100 yards, I was down to following a drop here and a drop there. I stopped to think things over. The wind blew, cut through me, and blew snow dust into my eyes. At a large outcropping, the drops increased in number, finally becoming a stream. After another 100 yards, it grew into a large puddle, suggesting that the thing had stopped there. A good sign. I dug at the snow with my toe. It was several inches deep and red. That was good. At least for us. The trail continued another 200 yards up through some smaller rocks and toward some squatty trees. I saw the tail first, the black tip lying flat across the snow, sticking out from beneath the lowest limbs of the trees. I took a deep breath,
drew the bow, and walked slowly toward the cat.
8 feet away, I set the front pin on its head, lowered it to account for the distance, and released the arrow. The arrow sliced through the neck. Only the fletching was visible. The cat never moved. I retrieved the arrow, hung it in the quiver, and sat on the rock, staring at the cat. She was not big, probably 5 feet from head to rump, and maybe weighed 100 pounds. I held her paw in my hand. Small or not, she'd have ripped me to shreds. I checked her teeth. They were worn, which would explain why she'd started hunting easy targets. I knew Ashley would be worried. I retraced my steps and found her in a good bit of pain. She was shivering and on the verge of going back into shock. I stripped her my underwear, unzipped her bag, and pulled mine up alongside hers. I climbed in, pressed my chest to hers, and wrapped my arms around her. She lay shaking for close to an hour. When she was asleep, I climbed out, wrapped both bags around her, stoked the good fire, fed it a little fuel, and returned to the cat. I caped it, which means I cut off the hide, and then gutted it. That left me with a mountain lion carcass of muscle and bone that weighed close to 50 pounds, giving us maybe 15 pounds of eatable meat. I dragged it through the snow, cut several green limbs, built a frame around the fire, and began hanging strips of meat. The smell woke her. She picked up her head, sniffed the air, and managed a hoarse whisper. "I want some." I tore off a piece, tossed it between my hands like a hot potato, blew on it, and held it to her lips. She chewed slowly, eating the entire thing. After a few minutes, she lifted her head, and I propped it up with part of her sleeping bag. Dark circle shrouded her eyes. I tore off another piece and held it while she took small bites. She laid her head back, chewing. "I just had the worst dream. You would never believe."
"Try me."
"I dreamed my flight out of Salt Lake was canceled, but then this stranger, a nice man, kind of homely-looking, but still nice, invited me to ride this charter flight with him on a short hop to Denver. So I agreed, but somewhere over this interminable forest, the pilot had a heart attack and crashed our plane. I broke my leg, and after nearly a week, all we had to eat was some trail mix, coffee grounds, and a mountain lion that had tried to eat us."
"Homely? Nice?"
"Nice was how we described girls in high school with good personalities." "You're unlike any doctor I've ever met." She chewed slowly. "The strange part of the dream was that I agreed to get on a charter with a total stranger. 2, actually. What was I thinking?" She shook her head. "I need to re-examine my decision-making paradigm." I laughed. "Let me know how that works out." In the daylight, I rechecked her leg. She was afraid to look, which was a good call because it wasn't pretty. "You're lucky you didn't re-break it. The bone ends are just now getting tacky enough to hold it in place, and there you go, pulling some stunt with a flare gun. I don't think you moved the bone, but the swelling came back with a vengeance." Her skin was pale and looked clammy. I repacked snow around the leg, adjusted and moved the braces to help circulation, then pressed her foot to my stomach to draw the warmth to it. For the rest of the day, we ate barbecued mountain lion and sipped warm water. I kept the snow packed around and under her leg and monitored the amount of fluid she was both drinking and expelling. She'd been lying still for 10 days, breathing less than half the oxygen she was used to. I was worried about atrophy and infection. If she got one, I wasn't sure her body could fight it. Once the protein hit my system, I rubbed down her right leg, her good leg, forcing the blood flow through it and stretching it as much as I could without jolting her broken leg. A delicate balance. Throughout the day, I continued cutting long strips of meat off the cat, feeding them through green boughs from an evergreen and suspending them above the fire. Several times throughout the day, I gathered fuel, taking me farther and farther from the cave to keep the fire hot. By nightfall, I'd carved off every available strip of meat I could find on the cat carcass and cooked it above the fire. It wasn't much. Wasn't even all that good, but it would fill us, give us some protein, some energy,
and maybe just as important, it would travel, which meant I wouldn't have to find food every day. When I'd finished, late in the afternoon, the color had returned to Ashley's face and cheeks. Maybe more important, her eyes were moist and healthy. With 2 hours of daylight remaining, I looked out the entrance and my eyes fell on Grover, lying on his side. He looked like a toppled statue. I strapped up my boots. "I'll be right outside." She nodded. As I passed by, she reached out, grabbed me by the coat, and pulled me toward her. She stared up at me, then pulled my forehead to her lips. They were warm, wet, and trembling.
"Thank you."
I nodded. This close to her face, I noticed how thin her cheeks had become, even drawn. I guess shivering for a week mixed with prolonged periods of shock and the absence of much food would contribute to a hollow, gaunt look. "I don't know how you managed what you did last night. It's a deep-down kind of strength." I looked away. "I've only seen one other time." I pressed my palm to her forehead, checking for fever. "Tomorrow morning, we're getting out of here. I'm not sure where we're going, but we are leaving this place." She let go of my hand and smiled.
"First flight out?"
"Yeah. First class, too." I crawled out. My stomach was full. And for the first time in 10 days, I was neither hungry nor cold. I looked around and scratched my head. Something was strange. Something I'd not noticed in a long time. Like something had crept up behind me that I'd not seen. I scratched my chin and it hit me. I was smiling. Chapter 18.
"You remember the turtles?
I wonder how they're all doing. Where they are. How far did they swim? Did they ever make it to Australia? Especially your little friend." You tapped me on the shoulder and said, "What's that sound?" "It seems we found the female just as she was starting to build her nest. We climbed the dune, lay down, and watched her dig a hole. She was huge and dug a long time. Then she started laying eggs, like she went into a trance or something. Must have laid 100 eggs. When she finished, she covered the hole, crawled to the water's edge, and disappeared into the black water. We slid down the dune and stared at the mound. It was one of the biggest we'd ever found. We carefully drove the spikes in a triangle, hung a line of pink surveyor's tape around the tips, and then you made me cut little flags to make sure that every beachcomber for a mile could see it. Planes flying overhead could see that nest. Then you'd started counting the days, like a kid at Christmas, marking the days on a calendar. I took a week's vacation, and at 55 days we started camping out."
"Well, they don't know they're supposed to hatch at 60 days. What if they come early?"
"We spread a blanket atop the dune, and you wore a flashlight on a strap around your head. Looked like a misguided coal miner. I tried to climb inside your sleeping bag, but you zipped up and pointed a finger at me."
"Nope. Not now. What if they start hatching?"
"Honey, when you get focused on something, you are a piece of work." So we lay there, watching the shadow of the moon across the tape line. The beach was warm that night. A cool breeze came up out of the southwest, so the ocean was more of a lake than a raging torrent. Then came the 59th day. You were asleep, drooling on your sleeping bag. I tapped you on the shoulder, and we hung our noses over the edge of the dune and watched the first baby shake the sand off his back and trek to the water. It wasn't long before the beach was crawling with loggerheads. You were so excited, counting quietly, pointing at each one like you knew them by name. I remember you shaking your head.
"How do they know which way to go? How come they don't get lost?"
"They have this internal compass inside. Tells them where the water is." Then came our little friend. He crawled out. But unlike his 117 brothers and sisters, he headed the wrong way, up the dune toward us. He made it a few feet, then bogged down, burrowing himself. The wrinkle grew on your forehead as you watched him dig his own grave.
"He's going the wrong way. You'll never make it."
You climbed out, slid down the dune, scooped him up with 2 hands, and carried him to the water's edge. You set him down, He found his sea legs, and the first wave scooped him up. It gave him a little push. There you go, little guy. All the way to Australia. We watched as the moon shone down on his shell, making him look like a floating black diamond. The breeze was blowing your hair across your face. You were smiling. I think we stood there a long time, not saying much, just watching him swim out to sea. He was a good swimmer, too. That was when you saw it. You turned around, stared at the dune where we'd been hiding in the scrub oaks and wire grass. A for sale sign stood at the highest point, so folks could see it driving up or down A1A. You said, "Who owns that?" "Don't know." "How much do you think they want?" "Probably a good bit. It's been for sale a while." "It's a strange-sized lot. Be difficult to put a big house on it. The area where you can build is rather small, while the protected dunes are big. Might have 100 feet of frontage on A1 and 800 feet of dune, like a squash triangle." "Yep. And you're surrounded by state park on either side, so there are probably restrictions on what kind of house you can build, how big a footprint, etc. Most folks who spend $1 million on a lot want to be able to build what they want." You waved your hands across the sand. "Must be 10 nests right here. There's enough pink surveyor's tape out there to mark the outline of a new subdivision. With all this activity, why doesn't the state buy it?" I shrugged. "Money, I suppose." You nodded. "We should buy it." "What?" You began walking up the dune, studying the layout. "We don't need a big house. We could put it right over here. A beach house, back off the ocean. And we could build it with big glass windows where we could sit at night and watch the nests." I pointed back down the beach. "Honey, we have a perfectly good condo right down there. We can walk down here anytime we like." "I know. But the next person to come along might not like the turtles digging up their front yard." "We do. We should buy it." A week passed. I was back in the grind of work. I walked in, threw my stuff on the couch, and saw that the sliding glass door was open. I walked out and found you standing on the beach. The sun had gone down. It was my favorite time. That cool, bluish light that falls before the darkness comes. You were standing there, a white sarong blowing in the breeze. You waved. You were so tan. Had tan lines drawn from your eye to your ear from wearing sunglasses so much. I put on some shorts, grabbed my folder, and walked out. You were wearing a smile and holding a small wrapped box. You handed it to me. The breeze had turned and was pulling at your hair again, streaking it across your cheek and through your lips. When I kissed it, you pulled it aside with your finger. I opened the card. It read, "So you can find your way back to me." I opened the box. It was a lensatic compass. You said, "Read the back." I turned it over. It was engraved, "My true north." You hung it around my neck and whispered, "Without you, I'd be lost." "I got you something, too." She put her hands behind her back, turning side to side. "Yeah?" I handed you the folder. You opened it, rifled through the pages. Looked like you were reading Greek. Your eyes narrowed. "Honey, what is this?" "That is a land survey, and this is a contract on a piece of property."
"What piece? We don't have..."
You stopped, stared at the survey, turned it sideways, then stared down the beach.
"You didn't."
"It's just an offer. Doesn't mean they'll accept it. I lowball them." You tackled me, an officer and a gentleman right there in South Pontevedra Beach. You were laughing and screaming.
"I can't believe you did that."
"Well, we don't know if they'll accept the offer. The property has some strong covenants and restrictions. There's a lot we can't put there. It's surrounded by state park, so..."
"Can we build a small house?"
"We don't own the property yet."
"Yeah, but we might, and when we do, can we build a small house with a glass front where we can watch the sun and moon rise over the beach?"
I nodded.
"How much is it?"
"A lot. We're not going to be able to build right away. It'll have to sit a few years."
"I can wait."
I loved giving you that piece of property. Chapter 19